This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on in the news today. Fidel Castro has stepped down. In the third hour of our program, we'll be talking with Saul Lindau, who is just an extraordinary authority on all things Castro in Cuba. And this is a topic that, of course, I've done some research on and co-authored a book in part about. Ultimate Sacrifice about JFK and RFK and you know, some of it involving Cuba and Castro. So I'm looking forward to that conversation in 2 hours. An hour from now, Jones Radio Network's Neil Bortz is going to drop by, conservative talk show host, and he's the author, along with Congressman John Linder, of a book and the proposal that Mike Huckabee is putting forward for the so-called fair tax, basically a nationwide sales tax. But I'll let Neil Bortz tell you about that in the next hour. In the first hour, I wanted to open a couple of different topics. The first is this whole John McCain and Barack Obama thing, where McCain is arguably, I would say the press is carrying most of the water on this. I'd say, you know, it's not so much McCain as it is the media is saying, well, you know, it's you said that you would take public financing. Why don't you do it now? And at the same time, McCain who, by the way, was the co-author of the McCain-Feingold bill on public financing, has gamed the system. He set this thing up with a bank where if he lost the nomination, then he would take the public financing and use that to pay off the bank loan that he used to bridge his campaign. But if he won the nomination, then he would be able to pay off the loan with money that he had raised in the fundraising, and they very clearly and explicitly made no commitment to do public financing. And in fact, the director of his campaign, his lawyer, John McCain's lawyer, told the Washington Post about, you know, setting this deal up for this $5 million loan. He said whether or not he would ultimately do campaign financing. He said, we very carefully did not do that. So this is, you know, Paul Kyle writing about this over at, I don't have the blog here, but he's writing about this, and he says, it's an arrangement that no one has ever tried before. And, yeah, apparently, and it's like John McCain, the bottom line is John McCain's trying to have it both ways. You know, John McCain to the Keating Five. Right, the old SNL scandal. John McCain is trying to have it both ways, and he may get away with it because it looks like, you know, nobody in the press is going to call him on this. Ben Smith suggesting over at Politico.com, how about something that, you know, here's a strategy, for example, for Barack Obama to toss back to McCain. You know, if McCain wants to say, oh, yeah, let's do public financing. See, that only kicks in the last couple months before the campaign and up until that, and by the way, then they'd let the 401 C4s or whatever they are, the old, you know, the new incarnation of the 527s, they'd let them do their campaigning for them. I mean, let us not think even for a moment that this is actually taking money out of politics. But in any case, Barack Obama could say, hey, let's just make a deal that neither one of us will take any checks for over $200, period, from anybody, under any circumstances, something like that. And I mean, there's a lot of ways that could be done. The whole issue of did Barack Obama commit plagiarism? This is, you know, yesterday I didn't even get into it, and the reason very intentionally, because I thought this is just, it's a joke. I mean, this is, you know, the Clinton camp apparently dropped this thing, and it's increasingly looking like this was planted on YouTube. By the Clinton camp. I shouldn't make that as an assertion of fact. It's just what I'm reading everywhere. on all the various political blogs is that apparently that was the source of it. Although, you know, nobody knows for sure. But, you know, the bottom line is, Barack Obama used a phrase that another person used, of all Patrick used, that had been, who is a friend of his who had shared with him, you know, here's how you respond to this. And these guys share the same media advisor. I mean, you know, this is not plagiarism. The plagiarism I'm concerned about, and this frankly should have been Obama's response. And I say this not as an Obama partisan. I'm still of the opinion that either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton would make a marvelous president. Either one of them would make a good president. But if the Clinton camp wants to throw at Obama that's plagiarism, the plagiarism camp, the claim that the Obama camp should throw back at the Clinton camp is, well, you know, if you're concerned about that plagiarism, how about the copying of somebody else's words? How about Hillary copying the words of George W. Bush that Iraq represented a clear and present danger to the United States and Saddam Hussein had ties to al-Qaeda? I mean, that is a plagiarism that, frankly, would concern me more. And you know, but I don't think that the Obama campaign is going to get into that kind of hardball. And frankly, I think it would be wise for them not to get into that kind of hardball. In other news and other areas around here, George W. Bush going off the rails. I mean, just off the rails. Ann Curry interviewing him and Laura, his wife, the first lady. And what's so amazing about this is you get the look on her face as he's talking and she's looking down like, oh, I can't believe that he's saying that. But this is Ann Curry interviewing George W. Bush.
Americans believe that they feel they're carrying the burden because of this economy. The economy they say is suffering because of this.
I don't agree with that.
You don't agree with that?
They say that this economy, we're suffering because of this war. He says, no.
It has nothing to do with the economy, the war?
I think actually the spending in the war might help with jobs.
Yeah,
because we're buying equipment and people are working. I think this economy is down because we built too many houses. And the economy is adjusting. We just have to kick out $157 billion to our taxpayers and businesses and other families so that we can get this economy going.
And the bottom line is that this economy has been hollowed out by the Bush administration policies. And going back to the Reagan administration, what we're seeing is the absolute natural consequence of Reaganomics, the hollowing out and destruction of the economy. And we're seeing a serial bubble situation. Back during the first Bush administration, when they deregulated the savings and loan industry, then, you know, there was this bubble that came about there and with the SNLs, and it blew up in their face and they had to bail out Neil Bush and all his buddies and the Keating Five and John McCain got caught up in that scandal, and you bet that's going to come back. And number one, then there was the dot-com boom, and then there was and bubble, and you know, we could go through all that, and then there was this housing bubble. But this is really huge. I mean, this and yes, wars do over a short period of time create jobs. Wars, yes. The problem is they don't create jobs that are lasting. There's a small amount of fiscal stimulus. I would submit to you that if Bush was not maintaining the occupation of Iraq and the attempted occupation of Afghanistan, that if we weren't spending $150 or so billion dollars a year, and probably more, frankly, doing those two things, that the economy really would be in the toilet. But, you know, an awful lot of that money is not ending up in the United States. You got Halliburton, who is the single largest beneficiary of all of the administration's spending, moving to Dubai. I mean, they're moving their headquarters offshore. They're saying, you know, we're out of here. And in the meantime, what we've seen is that unemployment has actually gone up. It's gone up from 4.4 to 5%. That's a 13% increase in seasonally adjusted terms between the end of last year and between December 2006 and December 2007. I mean, that's just not a good thing, right? And so, yes, we're creating jobs, but as with any war economy, if you take $100 billion and you build highways, you build factories, you build hospitals, you build schools, you build infrastructure, that $100 billion will become $1,000 billion. It'll become $1 trillion over time in terms of the return on investment. The kids who go to those schools get educated. The money comes back. The economy gets strengthened. On the other hand, you take that $100 billion and you build bombs and you drop them on somebody. That $100 billion has vanished. It has gone away. And we have an occupation and a war that so far, the best conservative estimates are going to suck $1 trillion out of the U.S. economy, and it's going away. Some of it obviously is being siphoned off by Bush's cronies and Cheney's buddies and Halliburton and these other companies, but that's about it. So what are we doing about it? Well, we're taking money from sovereign wealth funds, and the banks are starting to borrow money. Two very startling stories on the cover of the Financial Times today I want to share with you, and then we'll get to your calls at 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. And now, you know, for the really serious stuff of the day, there's two very serious issues here that really need to be aired. The first is the Supreme Court. This is why this presidential campaign is so important. This is why it's so important that a Democrat win. Frankly, any Democrat win. Well, not any. I mean, we have two, right? Either one of these two Democratic candidates win in the election next year or this year, this coming November, because the Supreme Court, it takes five justices out of the nine to decide to accept or reject an appeal. Well, actually, it takes five to accept an appeal. So if you want to get before the Supreme Court, you go to the Supreme Court and you say, you know, I'd like my case to be heard by the court. The process is fairly straightforward. You have to have five justices say, yes, we will agree to listen to this case. If they do, if five of the nine say yes, then you get put on the court docket. But if you can't get those five votes, then you don't get on the Supreme Court docket. And so you don't get to argue your case. You don't get the justice, I suppose, that theoretically, the Constitution entitles you to. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, sued the Bush administration and was talking about suing some of these telco companies about their phones being wiretapped. And as you know, I've said, I think people who really should be worried about their phones being wiretapped by the Bush administration, frankly, are the Democratic members of Congress. But they appear to be, you know, mind numb about that. Well, actually, the House now is taking a very strong position on this. God bless Nancy Pelosi. She's even, you know, calling the House into session periodically so that Bush can't, like, you know, sneak this thing through. But what's extraordinary here is that the ACLU in a lower court, the case was thrown out because they couldn't prove that their communications had been monitored. Now, you have the government, you have George Bush admitting that he has committed a federal felony. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act says that if you listen in on somebody without a warrant from a court, and you have 3 days to go get that warrant after you've already listened into them, if you don't take that procedural step, which seems to be no problem at all and hasn't been for many, many years, I mean, even the Washington Times opining about this, saying, well, it's not a big deal. So the ACLU goes to court and says, you know, these guys have confessed that they're listening in on our conversations, on everybody's conversations. We would like to sue over this. And the court said, well, you can't prove that they listened to you, so you don't have standing. You don't have the right to appeal because you can't prove that you are an aggrieved party. And they say, hey, you don't have a right to have a lawsuit. They say, let us have the lawsuit, and then we'll have discovery. Where, you know, we can subpoena the records and we can say, okay, who did you listen to? And if we happen to be among them, great, we win. If we're not,
then let somebody else take the gas. And the court said, no, you've got to prove in the beginning. Essentially, you've got to prove your case before you even start your case, which is absurd. I mean, this is Alice in Wonderland stuff. So they appealed it to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, no, we're going to let that lower court appeal, that lower court ruling that you guys don't have standing, we're going to let that stand. In other words, there weren't five justices saying, yeah, we're willing to listen to this thing. Because you've got Alito and Scalia and Roberts and Thomas, and all it took was one more, and increasingly Kennedy is going with these other four. You get these five justices who are going right, hard right all the time, it seems. And the next president of the United States, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is getting up there in age and has had cancer. And John Paul Stevens is, I think, 85 years old. He's an old man. And the odds are very high that the next president of the United States, certainly if the next president serves an eight-year term, it's a virtual certainty, will appoint at least one and possibly two, maybe even three justices to the Supreme Court. Kennedy's a fairly old guy, too. And that's going to determine the future of this country for a generation. Here we have the Supreme Court. I mean, in 2000, you had the Supreme Court deciding a presidential election in a way that arguably was not just inappropriate and unfair, but was illegal. And frankly, for which I'd be all in favor of impeaching a couple of Supreme Court justices, particularly Scalia and Rehnquist, although Rehnquist is dead now, but who had family members working on the Bush campaign. But on top of that, now you've got, you know, this court that has become so hard right that they're not even willing to say, you know, yeah, we're going to enforce the Fourth Amendment of the United States. That's a problem. And here's the other thing that I wanted to mention just very, very quickly. There are three front page stories in today's Financial Times. One is about how the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is having problems. Actually, that's a big issue. Another is how Australia is starting to say, okay, these sovereign wealth funds, you know, the Saudis and whatnot and the Chinese, we're going to start looking into this stuff. We're not going to let just anybody buy up our country. Maybe we should do that. And the third is that U.S. banks have quietly borrowed $50 billion. Big problem.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And strange stuff going on out there in the world. Actually, this is look out, our Jaws alert for the day. The St. Paul Police Department, listen up, folks in the Twin Cities. They're requesting 230 tasers to outfit all the department's officers with the electroshock weapon. Fox 9 News reports. This is by Andy Berkey. The SPPD will purchase the tasers with $210,000 collected from drug raids. The purchase is expected to arrive in St. Paul just in time for the Republican National Convention, prompting media speculation that the weapons are being purchased specifically for the convention. By the way, anecdotally, the death count resulting from taser use in the United States in February so far has been one death per week. Yeah. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. You're also welcome to drop by our live chat room, tomhartman.com. AirAmerica.com. Elliot in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Elliot, what's up?
Tom, hi, go ahead. Tom, the last hours of ancient sunlight was a revelation for me. Just that concept.
Well, thank you for buying and reading my book.
Yeah, and I gave it to people. Have you read Confessions of an Economic Hitman?
Yes. Yeah. And
Robert Redford? He's the one that should make the movie about that. That says so much about how the corporations have taken over so much.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure that book has already been optioned to make a movie out of.
That would be great. Yeah. You know, what I said to your screener was the legacy of George Bush is President Barack Obama, or perhaps Hillary Clinton. I'm for Obama. I just think that Bush screwed up so bad, there's no way that someone with such a progressive senatorial voting record, both of them, could have been considered at this time. And it's a godsend, because I really think that Obama may be able to, you know, I'm an old hippie, you know, from the 60s. working as a social worker now at a mental hospital. And I think that, you know, Reagan was elected in the 80s. And I think you know this. There was a fear that something really was going to change, because there was an authenticity and an energy in the 60s that kind of, I don't know, but I have a hope that now something can be kindled and changed.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Happens,
and
go ahead. And you know, your thing about how culture has to change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Freud wrote a book called Civilization as Discontent,
yes,
where he argues that there's no way that people can really be satisfied, because in order to what we do in modern civilization is we give up our instinctual, our satisfactions in order to feel safe. And so there's no way that we can really be fulfilled. Well, I
respectfully disagree with Freud, and I've read Civilization as Discontent. In fact, I quoted it rather extensively in one of my books. But Elliot, we're wandering all over the place here in this conversation. Bottom line, yes, I agree with you to a large extent that Bush has set up a progressive Democrat, and in fact has moved the entire Democratic Party in a more progressive direction. However, I think that that's where the American people have always been. Let's keep in mind, Ronald Reagan did not win because, hey, it was the wonderful Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter lost. Ronald Reagan, going into that election, right up until the last few months, Carter was ahead. Carter was way ahead. The American people thought that Reagan was this nutcase, right-wing crackpot. In fact, even his running mate called him a crackpot. Voodoo economics. Remember, that was George Herbert Walker Bush's phrase. And that he was a crackpot, you know, right winger from California who had shut down free public education in California and done a whole lot of other things that seemed totally weird. And that he was going to get us into wars, and he was going to spend us into the poorhouse, and he did. And that it was the hostages in Iran and Carter's inability to get those hostages freed that in the last few months led Carter's favorable ratings in the polls to start collapsing and brought up Reagan. I mean, let's just keep that in mind. But I think you're absolutely right. We are at a time of change right now, and it's a really significant one. Brendan, Long Island, New York. Hey, Brenda, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. We are a group of women, the Code Pink Women. Have you heard of us?
Yes, I have. I know Medea Benjamin quite. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we are here outside of our Congressman Steve Israel's office, trying to get him to agree to sign on to Robert Wexler's bill for impeachment.
For hearings.
Hearings, investigation.
Yeah, this is a critical point to make, Brenda, is that you're not asking Representative Israel to vote for impeachment. You're asking him to vote for an investigation into whether or not there were impeachable crimes committed. And therefore, it's a really rational request. You know,
right.
To simply say, hey, impeach the guy now, that's kind of irrational because you haven't had the hearings yet. And that's why Robert Wexler is calling for the hearings. He's done so on this program.
Yeah, and we met with him. He did say that we certainly think that the high crimes and misdemeanors bar is certainly, as we're concerned, did that. So it certainly will appear.
Brenda, you're breaking up there.
I lost him.
We lost Brenda. Anyway, so, okay, good. I mean, you know, this is the lobbyists stake out the offices of Congress, members of Congress all the time. I mean, there's over 30,000 lobbyists on Capitol Hill. I think it's great that the people are as well. Jim in New York City. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to make a comment that I don't know if it's a solution, but maybe you can contemplate this. I think a lot of the failure of education in the media, and it's purposeful in many ways, especially at the right wing, has no interaction with the person they're interviewing. So you mentioned Katie Couric's interview with Bush, and she asked a question about the economy, and he came back saying how great everything is, as he usually does, which...
Yeah, that actually wasn't Katie Couric. It was... I don't have the name right now at the tip of my tongue, but in any case, go ahead.
Okay, I just heard you
mention... No, it was Ann Curry. I'm sorry,
Ann Curry.
NBC's Ann Curry.
Yeah. That's important. And as television is non-interactive, so, you know, the listener oftentimes when the subject is dropped after you ask a question and a lie is returned or, you know, somehow the truth is not really candidly displayed, then the listener goes, okay, that's the answer. So Bush answered, and they go, oh, okay. The people who are unaware, at least.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, during debates, you know, McCain would come back and say, no, the war is sustainable. You have false information, when that's really not the case. So, you know, is there a way to say, well, excuse me, here are the facts that show that what you're saying is inaccurate? And that would be a way of really breaking all this chain of lies.
You can, to some extent, talk back to the media. I mean, most of them have contact sites and emails, and certainly a lot of bloggers are out there talking back. ThinkProgress.org has a whole thing on that particular Ann Curry clip.
What I mean on the mass media, isn't there a way to get a show together where you yourself, like, you really...
We did it here.
Tonight.
Did it. Yeah.
Sorry?
We just did it. I mean, you know, it's... And more people will do it. I don't... You know, one of the problems that you're identifying, Jim, is that we have this monolithic media.
Right.
And another piece of that problem is that we've gone from information and news to infotainment.
Right.
And reporters as TV stars.
Right.
And therefore they're afraid to lose their star status by questioning power.
Right.
And by speaking truth to power, as happened. Helen Thomas was the great example of that happening. And, you know, you ask one bad question of Bush, and boom, you're in the back of the room after sitting at the front of the room since the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah.
And I think the solution to this is to bring back enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act. These giant media monopolies that are not just even media companies, but are also defense contractors and food companies and entertainment companies and da 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 da. It's not good for the media, it's not good for democracy in America, and frankly, I don't think it's good business. It's, you know, monopoly is anti-competitive, and that's why, you know, people play the game. I mean, people go back and play the games. That's why the game was introduced in the 1920s, was to say, hey, wait a minute, these monopolies, this isn't a good idea. And, of course, then 1929 came, and we all found out that that wasn't such a good idea. Bernard in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Bernard.
Howdy. Like my old history teacher used to say, lies, damnable lies, statistics.
Yeah.
Unemployment. Them figures is and always have been wrong.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the right base number. I don't care what they say, 4%, 5%. They don't count the total number of people that are living within the borders at any given time. And they'll count somebody that's working two full-time jobs as two people working.
Right. So, and they'll count a person who's working one part-time job who does at minimum wage, who really is qualified for and competent for and perhaps last month had a full-time job at a living wage as employed.
And the other thing about the economy being so good, they keep talking about Wall Street statistics. That's not America's economy. That's people from all over the world who have money and that they've gotten out of the United States by selling us cheap goods.
Yeah, well, that's the Bush economy. I mean, that's, you know, Bush and Cheney. That's as Bush, you know, famously made the joke, you know, so here we have the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base. And that's what the Wall Street numbers are reflecting. You're absolutely right and well said, very well said. Bill in Seattle, just a minute before the break here. Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You mentioned the potential was to get good Supreme Court justices, reasonable people in there, and it just took me back to hearing over the weekend, or reading actually, Justice Scalia over BBC Radio said that it would be okay to waterboard terrorists if they might know the location of a bomb, or if to find out the whereabouts.
We discussed that on the show last week, in fact, and yes, absolutely, and he should recuse himself from any cases that have to do with that, and frankly, I think this is the seventh time now that serious national groups have called for Scalia to recuse himself from things, and he just laughs it off. Yeah, I'll go have lunch, I'll go shooting, hunting with Cheney, I mean, literally did this, and then rule on a case that has Cheney as the defendant before us. Scalia should be impeached. 45 minutes past the hour.
Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality of affordable health care for all Americans. because keeping our families healthy should be a right in these United States, not a privilege. Ron in Los Angeles, you have a solution to the problem of Scalia and company.
Well, I don't know about that, but what do you think about this? Should the Dems take office, do you think that they would have the guts to tap the Supreme Court justices' phones for playing politics?
Yeah, I mean, that should. This is what they should be screaming about. No, the answer is no. They won't do it. And in fact, by not allowing Bush to go forward with his so-called terrorist surveillance program, you know, future presidents won't be able to get away with what he got away with. And frankly, I think that and thank you, Ron, for making the point. And on so many different levels, future presidents will not be able to get away with what Bush got away with. And increasingly, I'm thinking Bush is going to get away with it, which makes me very, you know, somewhere between sad and angry, or both. And you know, let's convert that into activism as well, and try to hold him accountable as much as we can, particularly during and after his term of office, during the end of and after his term of office. But the point is that why are the Democrats not out there screaming right now? We know you guys are listening to us. Can you imagine if it was Bill Clinton who'd been wiretapping people illegally without a warrant, Newt Gingrich was in Congress? Can you imagine what they would be screaming about right now? It's just incredible. Lynn in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. This is Lynn Landis.
Hi, Lynn. The voting expert.
Yeah, well, I just thought I'd call to let your listeners know that about last week I uploaded onto my website the 1987 deposition of Leonard Gates, and he was a Cincinnati Bell employee. 23 years he worked for them, and he testified that in the late 70s and 80s, the FBI assisted telephone companies in hacking into mainframe election computers in cities across the country.
So you're saying that the Reagan-Carter election could have been hacked?
Yes. Exactly. And so if anyone wants to read that deposition, actually, I had to contact the Hamilton County Courthouse to get that deposition. Jim Condit also has a copy but was having difficulty locating it. So I went to the trouble of getting it, and it sat on my in my files for a couple of years before Jim convinced me to put it up on my website, and I'm really glad I did.
Yeah.
It is really
which website is it at?
This is the Landis Report. That's thelandes.com. And if you click on to voting in politics, I have it on the that front page on the left hand column under 2008 February 8th. And what I'm asking people to consider is that why hasn't the Department of Justice and the FBI investigated any of this electronic election fraud or irregularities? They stay very far away from it. And you know, as far as Leonard Gates was concerned, the FBI, you know, he contacted them, met with them personally, tried to get them to take action on this, and they wouldn't take any action. So
could it be that the coup has already happened? That the you know, the powers that be are just very happy right now having a system that they can completely control and docile politicians and I mean, what's your take on what happened with the vote in New York City?
Well, in the primary,
I mean, that was very strange.
Right. But I think, you know, when we had J. Edgar Hoover as the head of the FBI going around the country telling everyone there was no mafia, that was a great big red flag that he was protecting them.
Well, he was being blackmailed by them.
Right. Well, I think, though, that the government has been compromised for decades and decades and decades.
Yeah.
We're just becoming aware of it.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, you know, I think because of that, we do have them on the run. But we have to consider that I think these elections, particularly in the case of Clint Curtis, he had evidence his election was rigged by 16 percentage points. That's a big grab of for votes.
Yeah. And Clint Curtis testifying about how he was solicited to actually write voting hacking software and the whole thing. Yeah.
Right.
Great. Lynn, thelandisreport.com, the website. Lynn, thank you very much for sharing with us today.
You're very
Appreciate
welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. 866-303-2270, Joseph in Arcata, California. Hey, Joseph.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Two quickies for you. Response to the Hillary plagiarism last night on Keith Olbermann, he pointed out a number of different ways that Hillary had plagiarized, for example, John Edwards. Her camp had been questioned about this, and the response was that Senator Clinton is not running on the strength of her rhetoric.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty weak one. I've heard her say this is personal to me. That seemed like that was John Edwards' signature. But that's what people do. I mean, that's what politicians do. You get a good line there, and hey, that's a great line. You know, I'll use that line. I mean, Reagan's, you know, government is not the solution, it's the problem. How many Republican politicians have been using that since then? You accuse them all of plagiarism? I mean, give me a break. Larry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Larry.
Hello? Larry?
Yeah, you're on the air, Larry.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
All right, Tom. Listen, what I would like your audience to do and what I would love for the people of this country to do is to vote out every politician in office, whether you're a Republican, Democrat, I don't care.
Larry, there's some good ones. There's some good people out there. I'm sorry. This is not throw the bums out time. There are some very good politicians out there.
And what are they doing, Tom? I mean, are they looking to see who's sticking a needle in somebody's ass for steroids?
Larry, yeah, you're right. Actually, the whole issue of steroids is, you know, it's nuts that Congress is spending its time on that. And there a lot of very good legislation was passed. Nancy Pelosi's first 100 days was extraordinary. And the problem has been that the Republicans in the Senate have been tying this stuff up and that Harry Reid hasn't been forcing them to follow through with their filibusters. They just say, filibuster. And so we've had more Republican obstructionism in the Senate, more Republican filibusters in this congressional session than in any two-year term in the history of the United States. I mean, that's what's mind-boggling. They're playing politics with this so much. So, yeah, you want to vote out the bums, vote out all the Republican bums. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We have on the line with us now Neil Bortz, nationally syndicated talk show host, syndicated by the Jones Radio Network, and also the New York Times bestselling author and with John Linder of this whole fair tax idea that Mike Huckabee has so picked up. Their new book, Fair Tax, The Truth, Answering the Critics. Hey, Neil, welcome to the program.
How you doing? You know, they can't take this New York Times best-selling author stuff away from either you or me, can they?
Yeah, there you go. And it's nice, isn't it?
No, we have that forever. I don't care whatever happens to us.
There you go. Okay, Neil, so what's the latest conservative strategy here to make the rich richer and the working people poorer?
Well, actually, that is our goal.
I know, and you've been very successful at it for the last 26 years. Ever since Reagan came in, I mean, Reaganomics has just wiped out working people in America.
Well, answer me this, as they say in the South. What do you think of the idea that the rich keep getting richer because they keep doing whatever it was that made them rich, and ditto for the poor?
I think that for anybody to suggest that William McGuire was worth $1.78 billion for running the second largest healthcare company in the United States is absurd. You answer me this, Neil. Why should anybody earn $400, $500, $600 million a year as the CEO of a company? What skill could anybody conceivably have other than an old boy network or a corrupt system that would justify paying somebody hundreds of thousands of dollars a minute?
Well, I mean, you and I make that.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, seriously, you don't have an answer to that. Because, the system is broken here.
I do have an answer to that. And the answer is, I think your question was phrased by what excuse do you have for?
And no, what reason do you have for?
The reason is that in a free market system, it is not the government's role to decide what people will and what people will not make. Now, if the shareholders of a corporation or the owners of a business have a problem with what their executives make, then the shareholders and the owners are in a position to change that if they choose.
But that corporation came into being as a consequence of government. When you and I incorporated our businesses, presumably you and your show, me mine, and when I was living in Atlanta, the ad agency that I used to own down there.
Which one was that?
Say that again?
Which ad agency?
Chandler, McDonald, Stout, Schneiderman, and Poe, Inc.
Oh, my God.
The
it
newsletter
sounds like
factory.
A law firm.
Yeah, right. Well, it's an ad agency, and we sold it in 96. But in any case, when you start a business, and you know this, you're going to government, and government is providing the substrate for the business. It's providing a stable currency. It's providing an educated workforce. It's providing a commons. It's providing transportation. It's providing a court system to enforce the contracts that you enter into. Government is defining all these things for business. You're saying that there's this magical free market. It doesn't exist, Neil.
Tom, all of which you are paying for in taxes. I know.
All of which the corporations who are benefiting from should be paying for in taxes and were during the Eisenhower administration back when Republicans understood this stuff, but now they're not.
No, okay.
And so you're right. You and I are paying for it. We're being screwed.
In the last segment of my show today, I had a rather amazing statistic that ExxonMobil paid more in taxes to the government last year than the bottom 50%, the bottom 70 million taxpayers paid combined. Now, the bottom 70 million taxpayers, 65 to 70 million, they had income that was $970-980 billion. They paid less than $27 billion in taxes. ExxonMobil had an income gross of about $65 billion and paid about $28 billion in taxes. So with a fraction of the income of the bottom 50% of taxpayers, ExxonMobil, one corporation, paid more to the federal government than the bottom half of individual taxpayers.
So let me get this straight. What you're saying
sound like
is
they're
that
getting away much for to me.
Well, let me see if I understand this. It sounds to me, Neil, like what you're saying is that a corporation that just had the most profitable quarter in the history of the world, ExxonMobil showed a larger profit than any corporation since the Roman Empire, and arguably long before that, that corporation should be appropriately compared with somebody who works at Walmart
and is struggling to
put their kids through school and pay for food and medicine, and that person who works at Walmart should somehow be paying more taxes because ExxonMobil is profitable?
No,
I don't get it.
No, Tom, that's not what I said. You were making the case that the corporations aren't paying their share of the burden. I just told you that one corporation out there paid more in taxes to the federal government than the bottom half of all taxpayers in this country.
But the flip side of that, Neil, is that in the 1950s, corporations were, depending on how you calculate it and to what extent you're bringing state revenues in, corporations were paying between 35% and 45% of the total amount of taxation in the United States, and certainly were generating, or arguably were pulling out, about the same in proportion in revenue.
Tom,
and now it's down to around 17%.
Tom, we're arguing taxes now. I had hoped we were going to talk about the fair tax.
Yeah, let's talk. You're absolutely right, Neil. We've digressed.
One of the concepts of the fair tax is, in the bottom analysis, in the final analysis, all of the taxes paid by corporations, whether it's the mom-and-pop tire store or ExxonMobil, really, all of them are paid by the corporation's customers.
Not true.
It all rolls down.
Not true. Come on, Neil. Are you trying to have you ever read David Ricardo? I mean, you know, 1816 on profits. I mean, taking an Econ 101 class. If a corporation has expenses, those expenses may or may not show up in the price of the product. When Phil Knight figured out how to make Nikes cheaper overseas, he didn't drop the price of Nikes. He raised his profits.
Look, Tom, I'm going to cut to the chase here. I hung around the studio to talk to you about the fair tax book.
Yeah.
If we want to talk about that, I'll hang around.
Okay.
If you want to argue about other issues of right versus left or
no,
left,
I'm saying that your point that all corporations' taxes are actually individual expenses at the store is wrong. I disagree with you on that. And classic economics disagrees with you on it. But yeah, tell us why the fair tax should work.
Okay. the fair tax would work because it gets rid not only of all corporate taxes, but which are embedded. I mean, there was $22 million spent on a study by Harvard economists and other economists that determined that everything you buy at the marketplace, everything from a tooth filling to a toaster, has an embedded tax in it, which is the total combined taxes paid by everybody that was involved with bringing that to the marketplace. It ranges from a low of about 19% for leather goods. It gets up into the 25 and 26% range for other specialty items, but the average is about 22%. Now, this is embedded into the price of that toaster or anything that you buy. The fair tax removes all of those embedded taxes by getting rid of all corporate income taxes, all personal income taxes, all payroll taxes, and replacing them, replacing the embedded tax that comes out of the price of everything you buy with an embedded national retail sales tax. And Tom, the part that really ought to appeal to you in the rich versus poor argument is that even the President's Tax Reform Commission said that the fair tax is the only tax reform proposal out there that completely untaxes the poor in this country, completely at the federal level, untaxes the poor.
Assuming that they're going to do all the paperwork and they're going to get all
they
their...
They do no paperwork.
Like, you know, how often when you leave a country that has VAT taxes do you actually stop
by and fill
out the forms to get your refunds?
There is no
but Neil, you're suggesting...
for the poor to do any paperwork at all. None.
So you're suggesting that corporations in America who use the commons, they use our police, they use our fire, they use that they should not pay for any part of that.
No.
That simply consumers should pay for all of it.
Well, Tom, if you want to believe all wealth in this country is held by individuals, all wealth. In the case of a corporation, the wealth is held by the shareholders. In the case of a private business, the wealth is held by the owners. But all wealth is held by individuals. Therefore, since we tax wealth, all taxes are paid by individuals. Corporations don't pay taxes.
So you're suggesting that corporations aren't separate entities.
They collect taxes and pass them on to the government.
Neil, you want to stick around and continue this conversation
for another
segment?
Okay,
great, because we got a hard break here. I'm sorry. 16 minutes past the hour.
I like that.
That's all we do on this show.
That's very good.
Neil Bortz, Fair Tax, The Truth, Answering the Critics, his new book with John Linder. Check it out. We'll be right back with Neil Bortz. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Sing a song of taxes. Working class cancer sore. Tea in Boston Harbor. Revolutionary war of giving to the rich and taking from the poor. Sing a song of taxes, let's even up the score.
There's your song, Neil.
Song
welcome back. Neil Bortz, the Jones Radio Network syndicated talk show, nationally syndicated talk show, New York Times bestselling author, the Fair Tax book. His new book, Fair Tax, The Truth, Answering the Critics. This is the essentially national sales tax, doing away with income taxes. Neil, welcome back.
Absolutely.
Now, just to follow up on your last point, you said all wealth is held by individuals, which the corollary to that would be that a corporation is not an individual. And the corollary to that would be that a corporation, therefore, should not have standing. If it doesn't have standing as a tax-paying entity, if it doesn't have standing as a wealth-holding entity, then why should a corporation have standing for anything else?
Are you a lawyer, Tom?
No, I'm not. You are, though.
I'd be happy to discuss corporate law with you sometime if you want to do a show on corporate law.
Well, this ties back to your fair tax thing. Your fair tax does away with corporate taxes, and I don't get why.
The fair tax does away with all corporate, all business, and all individual taxes. Tom, do you understand that the poor working man that you're so concerned about out there, when he goes and gets his next job and the people say, we're going to pay you $24,000 a month, he knows that $24,000 a year, he knows that every single month he is going to get a check for $2,000. There's not going to be any withholding for taxes. There's not going to be any withholding for payroll tax, Social Security tax. There will be no withholding for Medicare tax. He gets his whole check. If he wants to save some of it, it is not taxed. He is only taxed on what he spends, and the items that he buys will cost essentially the same that they do today. And at the same time, businesses around the world and in this country will know that they can do business in the United States with no tax component on capital and no tax component on labor. Now,
Neil, let me get this straight. You're saying that if somebody's making $2,000 a month.
Yeah.
And their employer knows that they are, that, let's say right now they're getting a $3,000 a month paycheck, they're paying a third of it in taxes, they're taking home $2,000 a month. And their employer knows that they're willing to work for $2,000 a month after taxes. So we do your fair tax, turn it into a consumption tax, and now they're making $3,000 a month, but the employer knows this guy's willing to work for $2,000 a month. You think the employer's going to continue to pay them $3,000 a
month?
Well,
the employer, the cost to the employer for that employee has not gone up at all. But
in the marketplace of labor, they know that people are willing to work for $2,000 a month, so let's fire the $3,000 a month guy.
Have you read either one of these books?
I confess, Neil, I have not.
Okay.
Not thoroughly. I have read parts of them. I'd say I probably read about 40 pages of your book.
Now,
I am familiar, quite familiar with the concept, though.
Okay.
And with regard to corporate law, you asked if I'm a lawyer. No, I'm not. But I have written a book on corporate law that's used in law schools around the United States, and I've lectured in law schools on it. It's called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It's about the 1886 Supreme Court decision.
I'm familiar with it. Now, let me just give you one more thing. A survey was done recently. I'm very sorry because I'm not at home today, so I can't tell you the group. 400 foreign corporations. What would you do if you could go to the United States and operate with no tax component on capital or labor? 60% of the respondents to this question, which I think is about 240 of these corporations, said we would open our next facility, manufacturing, distribution, research, development, whatever, we would open it in the United States.
So, in other words, all the profits will go out of the United States back out to other countries. Shouldn't we be encouraging American corporations to develop things?
The other 40% said we will move our headquarters to the United States. One of the reasons that corporations flee this country, a quick lesson in Daimler Chrysler. When Chrysler and Mercedes-Benz, Daimler Benz merged, they hired accountants and bean counters. They said, okay, do we headquarter our corporation in the United States or do we headquarter it in Germany? They did the study of the tax structures of the two countries. They would take a 14% greater hit on taxes if they located in the United States. So it became Daimler Chrysler instead of Chrysler Daimler. Now, with the fair tax, where there is no tax component on capital or labor, it most certainly would have been Chrysler Daimler. We have $13 trillion in American assets right now that are working overseas to escape our punishing tax code.
No, I agree with you.
So
there's a great race to the bottom, but why not use things like tariff laws to, as we have historically for over 200 years, to say, or domestic content laws to say, no, if you want to manufacture that in the United States, if you want to sell it in the United States, you have to manufacture it in the United States.
Why do that when you can totally
Because then you keep the profit in the country.
Why do that when you can remove the tax component on business and individuals altogether?
Well, but you're not talking about removing a tax. You're talking about moving taxes around.
No, we're not. We're talking about the fair tax where you go out and buy your toaster, you pay the same for it today that you did yesterday, but there's no withholding from your paycheck, you don't pay any federal income taxes, you get to invest without tax consequences, jobs flow back into this country because businesses want to locate in the world's greatest tax haven, the tax base becomes so broad that the whole thing is just revenue neutral.
It sounds like a paradise, Neil. People should check it out. Read your book.
Okay.
Tax the Truth, Answering the Critics. Neil Bortz, Jones Radio News, or Jones Radio talk host and New York Times selling author. Neil, thanks for being with us. Neil? Thanks. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom's going to get you. Going to knock you right on the head.
You better get yourself together.
you. Well, it's up to all of us. That's called democracy. In a constitutionally limited representative republic. 34 minutes past the hour. We're going to pick up your phone calls here, 866-303-2270. But first, I just wanted to share with you two sentences from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote on April 6, 1816. He was writing it to a friend, Joseph Milligan, and it was in the context of his having completed the translation of D'Estaing de Tracy's book. Tracy was the guy who, his book that Jefferson translated from the French into the English, essentially created what is referred to as the French School of Liberal Economics. And a good chunk of it had to do with taxes. And the question of, you know, how do you tax things? What do you do? How do you decide what tax levels should be? What's the purpose of taxation beyond simply funding the cost of government? And Jefferson pointed out that they had to make a decision, that America has to make a decision. Do we tax property? Do we tax real estate? Do we tax people based on everything that they own? Or do we tax them based on what they earn? Okay, these were the things that they were looking at the time. And why? In addition to funding the services of government. Because at the time, 100% of the cost of government, this was 1816, 100% of the cost of government at that time was being paid for, not by income taxes, but by tariffs. By taxes on goods either coming into the United States or being, you know, moved from state to state. And so Jefferson writes this letter, and he raises these two issues that were the core issues that I think to this day we're still debating. He's talking about Tracy's book, and he's talking about his translation of it and all this stuff. He says, actually, let me just add one other sentence to it. He says, how far it may be the interest and duty of all to submit to this sacrifice, taxes, on other grounds, for example, to pay for the time of impost on the importation of certain articles in order to encourage their manufacture at home, or an excise in others injurious to the morals or the health of the citizens. In other words, are we going to have import taxes in order to encourage manufacture here, or are we going to tax things like tobacco so people, or alcohol so people don't get sick, will depend on a series of considerations of another order and beyond the proper limits of this note. The reader, in deciding which basis of taxation is most eligible for the local circumstances of his country, will, of course, avail himself of the weighty observations of the author. To this, a single observation shall yet be added. And this is Jefferson now talking as Jefferson. He says, whether property alone and the whole, in other words, shall we just tax people on their land and the whole of what each person possesses, or shall we tax them on everything that they own, which some countries do, shall be subject to contribution to taxes, or only its surplus after satisfying his first wants. In other words, or should we only tax people on what they have beyond what people basically need to live? Or whether the faculties of body and mind shall contribute also from their annual earnings. In other words, shall we tax people on what they earn with their labor of their mind or their body? Is a question to be decided. I'll read that again intact. Whether property alone and the whole of what each citizen possesses shall be subject to contribution, or only its surplus after satisfying his first wants, or whether the faculties of body and mind shall contribute from their annual earnings, is a question to be decided. And then he goes on to say, if the overgrown wealth of an individual be deemed dangerous to the state, the best corrective is the law of equal inheritance to all in equal degree, and the better, as this enforces a law of nature. Now, what he was proposing was essentially an estate tax. He was saying you can accumulate as much money as you want during your lifetime, but there is a maximum limit that you can pass along to future generations. And the reason for this was that the founders of this country had broken away from a country that had a landed gentry, that had multimillionaires and billionaires who basically had so much wealth that they controlled the government, and that they thought that that was an unhealthy, wrong, inappropriate, bad thing for democracy, small-d democracy, or for the Republic of the United States. And so here Jefferson lays out these two main concepts. Number one, or only at surplus after satisfying his first wants, which, by the way, is a part of Neil Bortz's fair tax. In other words, you know, if you're earning below a certain amount, you don't pay any taxes, arguably. I mean, I disagree with him on the fair tax, but to give him credit, that's in there. That Jeffersonian concept, that progressive concept. And the second, if the overgrown wealth of an individual be deemed dangerous to the state, the best corrective is the law of equal inheritance to all in equal degree and the better, as this enforces a law of nature. So anyway, I just tossed that out there for you to ponder. 866-303-2270, our number, Phil in Van Nuys, California. Hey, Phil.
Yeah, the thing is that the sales tax is a regressive tax. He didn't tell you that. He would have avoided the whole thing because the average person spends all his money on living and buying food, clothing, and whatever. And if that's all taxed, then he's paying more tax than a millionaire who buys more expensive items. But the point is, he only buys so many cars and so many airplanes and so many boats.
Right. Yeah. And for example, if Bill Gates is living on a $30 million a year budget but is making $1 billion a year, then he's only paying taxes on the $30 million that he's spending.
Yeah, and that's a smaller percentage than the percentage that a little guy is paying.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas somebody who spends 100% of what they earn, they're being taxed on 100% of their income. Now to again, and Neil isn't here to defend himself, but he does. They do address that by saying people earning below a certain threshold get a refund or a rebate of some sort on the taxes that they pay.
That's a good idea, and I think that people making $50,000 or less should pay no taxes at all, because if you're a couple making $40,000, you're in the poverty level. So $50,000 is slightly above the poverty level.
And essentially that's how it was in the 50s. I mean, we had progressive taxation in this country. We had a top marginal tax rate of 91%. And people who were working at the poverty level, people who were working at the equivalent of today's Walmart wages, were paying virtually no taxes. Phil, good point. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. Steve in Portland. Hey, Steve.
Hey, there was an article in Scientific America that actually quantifies what your previous caller said, comparing what percentage of each state's income came from the lowest 20% in terms of income.
Right.
And Oregon and Washington, Oregon had the lowest. Oregon has income tax, no sales tax.
Right.
Washington had the highest.
Because they have a sales tax, no income tax.
Correct.
So Washington is getting more money from the working poor. The state is taking more money from the working poor, and Oregon is taking less money from the working poor because we have an income tax and no sales tax. They have a sales tax,
correct,
no income tax.
Yeah, Oregon, 5% of the income is from the lowest 20% of the population. In the state of Washington, it was 17%.
Wow.
They control the bottom 20% controls what? 5% of the wealth?
Yeah.
3% of the wealth?
Oh, it's I think like that. Yeah, it's 3% or less, as I recall. Yeah, excellent point, Steve. Thank you very much for sharing those statistics and for the call. I appreciate it. Tim in Detroit. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Tom. Neil Bortz made a statement, and he cited a study, I think out of Harvard, that Exxon supposedly paid $28 billion in taxes last year out of their $40 billion profit. But assuming that's even true, if you go to sites like, for example, the Center for Economic Policy, they cite that Exxon gets a lot of those back in tax breaks, tax subsidies, for example, drilling on public lands and offshore exploration. And this applies to corporations across the board, that whatever taxes they supposedly pay, they get them in continual tax breaks.
Well, and not only that, it was an apples and orange comparison, and that's why I said, you know, hey, wait a minute, you're trying to compare Exxon to a guy who works at Walmart, you know, even as a class, even as a group of people. Come on. But again, Neil isn't here to defend himself. I'm not, you know, but your point is well taken. I'm not going to beat up on him when he's not around. Carl in Smithtown, New York. Hey, Carl.
This is Carl. I'm an accountant, CPA with 50 years of experience. And I notice all this talks about taxes, and I've worked with taxes. I remember when they came out with withholding tax.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that they don't talk about is, what do you do for retirement? When you retire, how and where do you get your funds if you're no longer working? when you pay money into Social Security, both you and your employer are investing in your future as a retired individual. This single VAT-type tax makes no provision or differentiation between anybody. And how does a poor person who is a part-time worker, who cannot invest and has no place to invest, have money to live when he grows older? I'm a man
of 85 years of age. You know,
yes.
Here's a quote from Neil Bortz's book, The Terrible Truth About Liberals, page 44. He says, the bum sitting on the heating grate, I'm sorry, the echo is pretty bad here, smelling like a wharf, is there by choice. He's there because of the sum total of the choices he made in his life. So I guess the bottom line would be, hey, if he didn't save enough money, tough luck. 45 minutes past the hour.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Say it ain't so, Joe, please. Say it ain't so. It's not what I want to hear, Joe, and I'm not a right to know. Say it ain't so.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, in the first hour, I said it takes 5 Supreme Court justices to decide to take a case. Somebody dropped into the chat room and said, no, you're wrong. It's a different number, but I popping in and out of the chat room while I'm doing the show, I miss things, and apparently it's scrolled off how many it takes. So I may have the wrong number on that. We'll find out. Hopefully somebody in the chat room will post the right number 2 or 3 times and in big type so that I can see it. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Charles in San Leandro, California. Hey, Charles.
Yeah, I visited the Congressional Budget Office a couple of weeks ago because I was baiting Hannity. But anyway, 90% of the people in the United States share 7% of the wealth, and yet they pay 29% of the taxes. It's really sad. And 10% of the people in the United States control 93% of the wealth, and yet they only pay 71% of the taxes. And where it really gets sad is when you look at the Forbes 400 list.
So hang on just a second. Let me just, you know, because these numbers, I think, kind of blow people's minds. Basically, what you're saying is that the reason, you know, when conservatives say, oh, look at this small percentage of the population is paying this huge percentage of the taxes. Well, the reason why is because they control an even huger percentage of the wealth.
That's correct. 10% control 93% of the wealth. And you would expect them to pay 93% of the tax, but they don't at all.
Yeah, they pay 70-something percent of the tax.
Yeah.
Right.
And the real fun thing is when you look at the Forbes 400 list, 400 individuals in the United States control 11% of the wealth.
Yeah. Yeah. And if the majority of their income is from interest and dividends, if they make their money now sitting on their butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive as they're sitting around the pools sipping a margarita, their maximum income tax rate right now is 15% under the latest Bush tax law thing change, whatever it was.
Can I ask Charles, one more question?
You certainly may.
Did you have a good time in Reno?
I had a great time in Reno, yeah.
My sister was up there and got a book signed for me. Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome, Charles. Thanks a lot for the call. Now, I had KJFK is a great station, good people there, and Reno's a great city. I had a great time. And fortunately, it kept me busy enough that I didn't lose any money in the casino. Mark in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Just fine. What's up?
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank
you. I was listening to this supposed right-wing intellectual with his fair tax stick.
Well, wait a minute. Neil represents himself as a libertarian, not as a right-winger. But
same difference.
Yeah, okay.
You know, practically, real life, same difference. And this Naverna that he's describing exists right now. I am part of his proposed fair tax. I work as a 1099 contractor.
Hmm.
There are hundreds of thousands of people just like me,
right,
who are responsible solely for their own income and their own taxes.
Right.
The experience is very simple. The only person who benefits is the employer,
right,
on every conceivable level. No union, no FICA, no this, no that.
Yeah, no unemployment liability, no...
Zero, 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 yeah. And you don't like it, goodbye. And it's a constant drive to lower the price of my labor. So this business of him proposing something that's new and radical and different has been in existence and then being used for as being used for the employer's benefit right now.
Yeah. So I suspect, again, Neil's not here to defend his position, and I will, I'm sure, do a very bad and imperfect job of it, but I suspect that, you know, what he would say is that that's not an accurate comparison of apples to apples, but it's not. I mean, you know, because he's talking about a national sales tax and also, you know, the rebates and everything for people who make under a certain amount, et cetera. And you and I as 1099 workers, for example, can't say, okay, I don't want to pay taxes below a certain threshold. Well, actually, with a progressive tax, income tax, I suppose you could. My opinion is
this is a whole industry of people developing these phony ideas to justify the fact that they don't give a damn for the working people who produce the labor and produce the value, that their attitude is, if we think about it, it's ours, and the hell with the guys who are working here. And my God, if we can get rid of the unions and have things our way, if we can get rid of people who have a different opinion from ourselves, that's wonderful. So this library has developed of these phony ideas, this voodoo economics.
Without personalizing it to Neil, I agree with you absolutely, Mark. And then thank you for the call. Toby in Brooklyn. Hey, Toby, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks a lot for having me on. Great
sure.
show.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to Neil and that statistic that he gave about ExxonMobil paying such a large percentage in taxes. The first thought that ran through my mind was that it's another statistic that's being massaged. And that I gotta suspect that a lot of those taxes are coming straight actually through the pump, being paid at the pump and just going through ExxonMobil and coming out of the people's pocket.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I don't know. It's his numbers and I don't have the details. I couldn't challenge him, but it would make perfect sense that most of those taxes would be federal highway taxes. Thanks a lot, Toby. John in Las Vegas. Hey, John.
And Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
Okay, basically talking about this retirement deal. Why not just let people die with their boots on?
In other words, work forever and never retire.
Yeah, why not?
Well, I think because at a certain point you physically and for many people mentally as well reach the point where you just can't work anymore. I mean, there's always been this sense. You look at Aboriginal societies, Indigenous societies, and, you know, the elders are respected for their wisdom, but they're not asked to go out and gather the food any longer. You know, in fact, in many societies, the elders are
not an Aboriginal society, Tom.
No, well, we are actually. We actually are. I think we have a lot to learn from. Are you seriously arguing that people should work until they die?
Yeah.
Why?
Why not? What's so wrong about that?
Because I think that the idea that in your old age you can have a break is just a reasonable one. I think it's human. It's human. I don't know how to say it beyond that. 57 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program. The Tom Hartman Program. Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Fidel Castro steps down, end of an era, or end of a reign of terror, or a little bit of both, or a little of neither? What is it? Professor Saul Landau is with us. He's an author, filmmaker, lecturer, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's produced over 40 films on social, political, and historical issues, worldwide human rights, for which he won the Lettlier Moffitt Human Rights Award, the George Polk Award for Investigative Reporting, and the First Amendment Award, as well as an Emmy for Paul Jacobs and the Nuclear Gang. He's written over 10 books, short stories, and poems, receiving an Edgar Allan Poe Award, and on it goes. Professor Landau, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
What does Fidel Castro's stepping down mean both for Cuba and for the United States?
Well, you know, the irony is I don't think it means much at all, other than he is the, Guinness record book holder for disobedience.
Disobedience?
Yes, he's been disobedient to the United States for almost 50 years and survived. That makes him unique, and certainly in Latin America. When one assesses what he's done, he has administratively institutionalized all of the basic systems that now exist in Cuba. When he went into the hospital about a year and a half ago, the next day, nothing changed. The buses showed up late as usual. People went to work. They came home. Nothing had changed. His brother, Raul, with whom he has been partners in every enterprise since 1953, is now president of Cuba. So why would we expect something to change?
Well, Raul's getting to be an old guy, too.
Yes. And when he goes, again, I mean, the major change, Tom, and I think people should understand this, is that Castro had unique charisma. And I say that having made several movies with him for U.S. television, for public television and for CBS. He vibrated power. Nobody can fill his boots. From now on, Cuban government will be run more or less by committee, not by a single monstrous-sized will. Yeah. As he had.
Can that be done, though? I mean, it seems that in a democracy, small d democracy, the idea is that the committee is all of the people, and Cuba has certainly not been democratic. Although it's, I suppose, you could argue that neither has the United States in many regards. But is his form of communism? Or I'm reluctant to call it socialism because, you know, the Swedes call themselves socialists. Is his form of communism something that has become an anachronism, or can it survive into the future? And if so, should it?
Well, the answer to the first question is we'll see. Should it in its present form? No. I think it needs bad reforms. But I think in order to appreciate what Fidel Castro has done, you have to go back. In 1958, Cuba was an economic, albeit an informal economic colony of the United States. The United States owned the major sugar mills, the best land. They owned the utilities, the telephone companies, the mines. They controlled the banks. They ran the foreign trade of Cuba.
Right, and what our corporations didn't own, the mafia owned.
And the mafia owned the gambling and the prostitution and so on. That was 1958, when the United States controlled Cuba.
With Batista, another dictator who was our puppet.
And in the last days of the Batista dictatorship in December of 1958, several of his generals and admirals hijacked planes and ships and filled suitcases with money they stole from the Cuban treasury and went to the United States with these hijacked craft. The Americans let them in with their stolen money and their stolen craft, never charged them. Now, ironically, from 59 on, what has Castro done? He's built a nation. Now, if you just sit back and examine, what was the aim of the Cuban Revolution, which started, by the way, in the mid-19th century against Spain, in the first Cuban War for Independence in the 1860s, and in the second Cuban War for Independence in the 1890s, which the United States stepped into and sort of deviated from its course of against Spain and essentially made Cuba into a colony of the United States.
With the blowing up of the USS Maine, you're suggesting we basically stopped the Cuban Revolution and instead turned that into the Spanish-American War and used it to grab Cuba and the Philippines and other territories?
Yes, I don't know who blew up the Maine, but that certainly served the purpose of intervention. Now, what Castro has done is continue on in that trajectory. He's made Cuba into a nation where the people are healthy, the people are educated. If you want to compare infant mortality of the United States and Cuba, Cuba wins. If you want to compare life expectancy, they're the same. Now, that's weird because we're a rich country and they're a poor country. If you want to look at what Cuba did, you look all around the world in Cuban scientists, doctors, athletes, filmmakers, artists, writers have all etched their names in the honor rolls in Pakistan, in the Middle East, all throughout Africa and Latin America.
But to what extent have those people been people who voluntarily left Cuba or were allowed, you know, Cubans who were doing those things as opposed to Cubans who fled Cuba. I mean, I think the stereotype in America is of the Cuban who is you know, hijacking a plane to get out of the country.
I'll get to that in a minute, Tom, because a lot of people did leave Cuba. That's the downside. But if you think about what has been accomplished, these are people who volunteered for these missions. Cuban troops changed the destiny of Southern Africa in 1987 and 88. They fought and successfully with the South African apartheid armies in southern Angola and defeated them. And literally, they had so many casualties to the white apartheid army that South Africa had to change its strategy, let Nelson Mandela out of jail. And I don't know if you recall, but I recall watching on television when Mandela was being inaugurated and shaking everybody's hands, and Castro extended his hand. Mandela pushed it away and grabbed him in a bear hug and said, "You made this possible."
Mm.
Well, this is what Cuba did. They had doctors in tunnels in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and they fielded, most people don't know this, a tank unit in Syria in the 1973 war. In other words, Cubans danced on the stage of world history. Now,
in a way that disagreed with American interests.
Always. And look at the change in Latin America today. And I'll stop there in terms of the good stuff, because you have four of Fidel's ideological sons running governments in Latin America today. I'm talking of Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales in Bolivia, and Correa in Ecuador. And several of his relatives are also running countries. Lula in Brazil, who just dropped $1 billion of credit onto Cuba. Michelle Bachelet in Chile. Mrs. Kirchner in Argentina, the new government in Guatemala, and I think more will be coming. Now, that's what Castro has accomplished. Now, what's the downside? Because there is one. First, divided family.
Mm-hmm.
That's a major problem. I mean, there's 1.5 million Cubans living in Miami, or Cuban Americans now, or some of them are citizens and some not. Secondly, Cubans have been deprived of lots of procedural liberties. Not that they had them before, Tom, because this is important to think. For 500 years of Cuban history, maybe there was 25 or 30 years of, quote, democracy, unquote. And this was all characterized by gangsterism, the most yellow journalism in the so-called free press you could imagine, corruption on a scale that's hard to believe. So the experience that they had with freedom in 500 years has been very tainted.
Right.
But nevertheless, there were...
But Castro does put people in jail for speaking out against him.
Yeah, well, not for speaking out against him, for trying to organize against him. I've been on Cuban buses where people have said, Fidel Castro is a no-good SOB, and everybody sort of shrugs their shoulders. But if you write something and try to hand it out, then you get busted.
You can't
organize a political party. There's no free press. Well, really, no
so
press.
Would it be possible for Cuba to make a transition to become essentially the Switzerland of the Sweden of the Caribbean by taking the all these doctors that they have and the free public education and the infrastructure that they have and adding to that the freedoms that you're saying that they don't have, the democratic institutions?
Well, look, if the United States truly wanted to see change in Cuba, all they'd have to do is lift the travel ban and the embargo.
Yeah.
Imagine 2 million Americans pouring in their fat wallets.
Yep. Yeah. Well, people have been saying that for forever.
That's it. If you don't want change, you keep the embargo and the travel ban. And that's what the Bush government has done.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous, except if the payoff goes to your supporters.
Yeah, because the bottom line is that tyranny could not withstand, or whatever. I mean, the despotism couldn't withstand that kind of openness.
That's exactly right, Tom.
That's right. Okay, Saul Landau. Saul, is there a website you want me to let people know about?
Well, sure. They can go to the Institute for Policy Studies, ips-dc.org, or saullandau.com.
Great. Saullandau.com. Thank you very much. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Yeah, when we fall down in life, we best get up again. Many are the trials and tears we must overcome. Learn to take it easy.
4 minutes past the hour. Oh, man, the cons are just going nuts. Glenn Beck last night. Oh, the president.
Remember, we came up with all kinds of new aggressive new laws to combat a new kind of enemy.
No, we gave up this let's give a free pass to Bush, Glenn, law, and it had nothing to do with combating terrorism. It had to do with whether or not Bush could break the law.
It was a Patriot Act. Another one was a Protect America Act. This was
Protect America. Why don't the Democrats name things like, yeah, I'm still, it's like, no, it's LIHEAP. No, it's the low income housing assistance program or heating assistance program. It's LIHEAP. It's SCHIP. No, it's the state children's health insurance. Protect America. The Republic, how do they, well, anyway, I am blue.
An extension of our eavesdropping. It helped our government listen in and find terrorists. Well,
or find Democrats. Anyhow, he goes on and he says, this congressional game played by Nancy Pelosi will end up killing Americans, believe it or not. And it's this guy, our bozo alert for the day, right? Glenn Beck, 866-303-2270, our number. Rick in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? First, I saw you talk in Agoura, and as a testament to how riveting it was, we had to sit on the floor behind the podium. And long after my butt fell asleep, I was still very entranced.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So thanks.
And my apologies.
I had a question about
your rear.
What's that?
My apologies to your rear end.
Oh, thank you very much. I think it's since recovered. Neil Bortz had brought up the item about how we would pay for a toaster the same today as we would have paid for it yesterday as a way of paying the taxes on it. You recall him saying that?
I don't recall that exact phrase, but he may well have said it. It seemed like sort of a free lunch, but...
Right. It did sound that way. So my question, if you did understand it, was how was that supposed to happen? Are they going to shift the taxes that they're now paying directly to the government and take it out of their profit, which is highly unlikely? That particular item just didn't make any sense.
Yeah, I just have to say I have not, as he pointed out, I have not thoroughly read his book and don't know or understand how that could work, and it doesn't make sense to me either. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it, and thanks for showing up at our book signing. Anna in Greeley, Colorado. Hey, Anna.
Hey, how you doing?
Just fine.
I really miss hearing you on 760. I quit listening to them after you are not on there anymore. I just wanted to say something about hooray for having the guy on to say good things about Cuba, because Cuba is a good place. And communism.
Have you been there?
Huh?
Have you been there?
No, but I know a lot of people who have.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always supported the revolution because, hey, the people lived in a feudal society, and they did work for the mafia. And we had appointed the dictator like we have appointed all the dictators around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And communism is an economic system. It's not a...
Well, the way that Castro practices it and the way that the Soviet Union practices it, it's also a political system. And it's a political system that does not allow for dissent and does not allow for the will of the majority. And therefore,
I'm not
a big fan of it.
Do you think we do? I mean,
I think that we do much more than Castro did.
How come they're spying on me? I dissent all the time. I call the local school system and say, you want to teach people to read? Get some Cuban teachers over here. And,
well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, Cuba, this is where I'm saying, why don't we help Cuba become the new Sweden of the Caribbean?
Anything, you know, whatever, you know, they're all for their people. And, the people who moved over here who became CIA thugs and blew up airplanes are here.
Well, that's not all the people who moved over here. That was one guy.
No, actually, there are two.
A few of them, but they're hiding out down there in Florida.
Yeah.
No, and I get your point, and you made it very.
And they're also godless, which is really a good thing.
Well, so are we. Our government is secular as well. I mean, we don't, you know, there's no God in our Constitution. And I realize we've got a bunch of politicians who aren't, but, you know, that's the way it is. Anyhow, Jamur, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. Jamur in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jamur, we've got about a minute here before this break at the bottom of the hour.
I will be real quick. I love you to death, Tom Hartman. I wish there was more men out there in this world like you. I hate to disagree with you on one point. Our youth is not without prejudice. If anything, it's worse. There's more hate crimes than ever in the gay populace. There's also a lot more hate crimes in the black race. We have an interracial president running, and yet they call
don't,
it black.
Don't you think that if there is an increase in hate crimes against gays and crime within the African-American community, that that's a direct consequence of all the gay-hating rhetoric of the Republicans over the last 20 years
and
the poverty in the black communities that's
a
result of Reagan's policies?
No, right in L.A., you have a young man who went to school that was openly proud to be gay. He wore a little bit of makeup and jewelry and stuff like that, and he was killed by a youth, and it was an out-and-out hate crime, and that's just one good example.
No, I understand, and I agree with you, what I'm saying is that it seems to me that when these politicians do this thing about, oh, we got to amend the Constitution to keep the gays out of our schools and keep from getting married kind of thing, that what they're doing is they're encouraging those kind of hate crimes, and that's what I'm condemning. Jamora, we're out of time. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Station with plasticine quarters with looking glass time.
Oh, I remember this song. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends. $456.1 billion is the amount of money that George W. Bush and the Republican Party and a few willing Democrats in the United States House and Senate spent just on our war and then subsequent occupation of the country of Iraq. Now, what could that... Now, this is just as of last December. What could that $456.1 billion, which we have already spent, arguably a large, perhaps even the largest single portion of, has been transferred to Halliburton. What could that have bought? We could have provided health care to 130 million people. I mean, you know, speaking about what Castro did, again, not to defend his despotic policies, but we could have provided we could have given renewable electricity. We could have put solar panels on homes so that they generate 100% of their electricity, 472 million homes. I'm not even sure there's that many homes in America. We could have hired 10 million police officers. We could have hired 7,900,000 music and arts teachers. We could have provided 75,290,580 full four-year scholarships for university students at state colleges. We could have built 45,000 new elementary schools. We could have provided 194 million children with health care. We could have put 62 million children in Head Start. Throughout their childhood, we could have hired 7,765,000 elementary school teachers, or we could have hired 6,854,000 port cargo inspectors, as if we need that many. But instead, that money went to Northrop Grumman and Halliburton and all the big defense contractors and to the military and to the Pentagon, and got dropped on top of Iraq. I mean, it's crazy. I read these conservative sites and they go, I got an email this morning about, we want to put $200 billion into New Orleans. Well, if you divide the population by that, that means each family is getting, X number of million dollars or whatever. Yeah, well, divide the $458 billion we've spent in Iraq into the population of Iraq and think what we're spending per Iraq. I mean, it's just, anyway. Sasha in San Francisco. Hey, Sasha, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
Good. I'm just calling in regards to the whole Fidel Castro situation. I actually was in Cuba for an entire summer.
Mm-hmm. What
I think the biggest problem is the fact that it's the embargo that is creating a lot of the problems in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And actually a lot of the issues that the Cuban people have is the lack of, being able to receive products. And that has been the crunch for, for decades now due to what, you know, the issues that our government has with Fidel and also the issues he has with us.
Yeah, it seems to me that if we did away with the embargo, that the Cuban government would then face a real crisis, because if people could come and go freely on both sides, and if money could be exchanged freely, mm-hmm. Relatively speaking, I mean, you know, within the constraints of rational trade policies,
right.
It would be very difficult. I think, you know, experience demonstrates that it's very difficult for a regime that essentially rules by an iron fist to maintain itself,
right.
to maintain its power.
Well, and then also you have to consider, I mean, you know, how it was before Fidel, I don't mm-hmm. think it was any better. And I think that a lot of people who do support, you know, that government or that, you know, revolution are afraid of that. It was terrible before. The, you know, Baptiste, who we supported, was not a nice person.
No.
Was not, you know, he did not care about the Cuban people.
Yeah, he was a thug.
Unless they were, you know, white people.
Yeah.
But I was there the entire summer. I lived like the Cubans lived. I did not stay in the fancy hotels, which they do have.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived it, and it was an experience that I'll never forget. The most wonderful people you will ever meet.
Mm.
Outspoken, just as much as we are. Just, you know,
yeah.
mostly in their homes, obviously.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful experience and a beautiful piece of land that, you know, hopefully does not. They're very sustainable, let's put it that way. I ate organic the entire time I was in Cuba.
Yeah, and when, you know, hurricanes hit, they're ready to respond. I mean, we can't even handle, you know, look what happened in New Orleans, and Cuba gets hit with hurricanes even worse than that, and they recover very quickly.
Okay,
Sasha, I've got to move along.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Pam in Seattle. Hey, Pam.
Pam? Hi, Tom, and I also want to go rah-rah Cuba, because I was there, and my uncle lived there, and he had a couple of his children there in the early 50s, and they had to leave. He was an English teacher, but they had to leave because they couldn't get enough protein to feed their babies under the Batista regime.
Hmm. This is pre-Castro.
Yes.
And see, this is the thing. I mean, it's such a terrible conundrum, because here you have Cuba has more doctors per capita than Beverly Hills, which is pretty high in doctors. And I mean, they're exporting doctors to the entire world.
And the educational system allows for that because it's free education and they really encourage it. We visited a hospital. It was in an old bank building, interestingly, an old Bank of America building. They just built the hospital above it.
Mm-hmm.
And they let us know there wasn't a Q-tip in that hospital from the United States. They had to import everything from Japan.
Yeah.
But encourage people to see Saul Landau's movies. He's brilliant on Cuba. He's been there so many times. He was actually there working with the famous C. Wright Mills in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
A very interesting history, and people need to know this stuff. And one of the things that really hits me now as we look at the idea of having an interracial president is when I was walking the streets, and I was there with professors from communication studies. We were looking at the communications, the radio system,
mm-hmm.
going to schools and seeing how kids were learning to do radio plays.
Right.
And they had a radio station right in the middle of their school. And as we met with folks, I had this incredible feeling of not feeling prejudiced. And
mm-hmm.
and the black professors in our group said, for the first time in their lives, and they were professors, They didn't have that weird feeling of people looking down on them. And it's the kind of thing I'm getting as I read Barack's books, what he went through as a young person, you know, coming to grips with racism and people, you know, his family were all white. So, of course, he had this double whammy going on inside of his head. And as I read his book and you really get into his whole mind state, it's absolutely fascinating. And I relate to when I went to Cuba and I felt that.
That it was a functioning interracial society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And obviously there are prejudices, and it was kind of rough to, you know, the really cold black kids would come up to us and say, you know, could you give me American dollars? I want to get on a boat and go to the United States.
Mm.
And I would feel like, oh, my God, you know, because it was like they did have opportunities. They had no idea what they were going to face in Florida when it comes to the prejudice.
So then it's a semi-functioning interracial society,
better. Well, the opportunity, but, you know, the difference in opportunities, they knew how to read. They were an incredibly, and we met with a lot of students, and they all had opportunities, so they knew how to read. No, they, you know, of course, we always say, well, they don't, you know, there's the censorship. But at the same time, they all learn to read. It's literate.
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
difference between that and not being able to read because you have bad schools.
Right. And that whole thing with opportunity. Pam, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. That whole thing with opportunity is like when I was at the Mensa group, when I was keynoting the Mensa conference, what was it, Friday night, Saturday night, this last weekend in Los Angeles. And somebody asked the question, you know, or actually it was a teacher. She got up and said, made a comment to the effect of, you know, in some schools there are dropout rates over 50% in the United States. And, you know, how can we, you know, talk about reforming our education system when we have these massive dropout rates? And my point was that kids are dropping out of high school now, the kids who are struggling with school, because who 30, 40, 50 years ago would not have dropped out of high school. Because 30, 40, 50 years ago, a high school diploma meant that you could get a good job and you could raise a family, you could buy a home and a car, and you could put your kids through school. You could get a job. You could get a job at General Motors and, you know, get a good union job, and you had it. A high school diploma was enough. And nowadays, a high school diploma isn't enough. Now it's you have to have a college degree. And without that college degree, you can't do anything. And so kids who are struggling and might have just pushed through to get that high school diploma before are now saying, you know, even if I get this, it's going to be, do you want fries with that? I mean, even if I get this, it's going to be, welcome to Walmart. There is no future here. What, you know, so why bother? I can make more money as an entrepreneur selling dope on the streets or something. I mean, this is the kind of thinking that's happening. And frankly, there's an economic reality associated with it in this country. Because of 27 years of Reaganomics, because the New Deal has been essentially rolled back. I mean, this is what we are seeing. And it is the destruction of America, the hollowing out of America from the inside out. And then in the front page of today's Financial Times, this article about how America's banks, because see, we're not producing wealth anymore. We're just trading money with each other. America's banks have secretly and quietly, as if it is the headline, quietly borrowed $50 billion from the Fed. And we're looking at a possible bankruptcy crisis in the United States. Reaganomics is destroying this country. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back to Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. We're going to hear from Talk Radio News in just a moment, but first I wanted Fidel to get an opportunity to just pop in, and you wanted to put a contrasting note to some of the previous callers, Fidel, and I didn't want to pass the opportunity to give you the microphone here for a second.
Thank you very much, Tom.
In Jersey City, New Jersey, I should add.
But yeah, thank you very much, Tom. I just want to say that although I am one of the Cubans that I'm strongly against the embargo because I don't see any good in it, I think it's a big mistake that people romanticize what has been a regime and nothing short of a dictatorship with Castro, and that although it may seem on the face of everything that there are very good points, the fact still remains that people have still, to this day, are hungry. My family lives there. I know the hardships that they go through. My uncle, for one, I have so many stories that I can tell you, but I'll tell you one. My uncle, everybody keeps touting the benefits of the health system over there. My uncle had a prosthesis that he needed to have replaced because the one that he had gotten in Cuba was now deteriorating, and the system would not cover him. So What he did was he came to the United States and had the procedure done at Jersey City Medical on the charity care. So, you know, there are a lot of things that we can debate, whether this country has failed us, the people. However, we can't lose sight of the fact that Castro is not this benevolent gentleman.
No, he's not a small D Democrat at all. He puts people in prison for speaking out against him.
He absolutely does.
You're absolutely right. We can't forget that. Fidel, I got to move along. Thank you very much for speaking out. I appreciate it and for offering that counterpoint. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Hey, the Clinton folks just had yet another conference call about an hour and a half ago, this time that they're saying that they're not going to go after pledged delegates and that they don't want the Obama campaign to go after pledged delegates. So we'll see what happens on that front. Mm-hmm. Also, the Supreme Court today turned down a case, the ACLU versus the National Security Agency. This was trying to go over a 2-to-1 Court of Appeals on the Sixth Circuit. If you recall that,
yep.
Michigan judge said that what the NSA was doing was unconstitutional. Then she was overruled 2-to-1 by the Sixth Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court said the ACLU has no standing, essentially because they can't prove that they were wiretapped.
Right.
The catch-22 of all time.
Yeah, it really is. And now, does it take four or five members of the Supreme Court to say
four?
Yes, well,
four have to take a case.
Four have to take the case. Okay, I said five earlier. I was wrong. And somebody in the chat room pointed that out, but I didn't catch the number. So
yeah, okay. Four.
So basically, Scalia, Thomas, Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Roberts, those four guys. Well, no, it would take five to block it, wouldn't it? So
right.
they must have had at least one ally who said, you know, or actually at least two allies who would have said, no, we're not going to hear this case.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
Okay, on a couple other things. Today, I would say, is the day that we don't have to be very proud of our government. We'll start out with John Dingell. He wrote, Chairman Dingell wrote a letter to the EPA saying he's very worried about drinking water supplies in Colorado. The governor there is very worried about the runoff and contaminated drinking water. They're also worried about drinking water in parts of California, and he wants the EPA to work on it. Meanwhile, two other issues. The House panel, the U.S. Attorney Christopher Christie has been awarded, or he awarded to former Attorney General John Ashcroft a multi-million-dollar contract, and that will be heard before the House subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee on Tuesday. Also, another House panel from the SBA is going to look into a newly retired Bush administration appointee. He got a $1.2 million contract. 90% of the SBA's budget to provide advice and training to small disadvantaged businesses, and it went to a group called the VBP Group based in Arizona. And so here you have all of this, and then the USDA is going to finally step up oversight of the situation with the beef recall, the 143 million pounds of beef. But, I mean, you have had to push these agencies to the wall to get any kind of traction.
Yeah. Well, this, I mean, here it is. It's just...
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And therefore they're doing away with the government.
I guess so, 100%.
Yeah, and this is just and all the more the tragedy. I mean, it's and this beef thing, and you would think that we would have learned from Katrina, for example, you know, that Bushism and Reaganism doesn't
work. Speaking of Katrina, the Supreme Court came out with another little winner today. They agreed with the lower court, no flood damage to Xavier University and 68 businesses, and that's because their policies did not do flood damage, even though the flood damage is essentially made from the levees.
So the Supreme Court basically said, no, you can't get what, insurance or federal funds or what?
You cannot, your insurance companies don't have to pay.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. The Supreme Court defending the companies, the corporate, you know, John Roberts, a multimillionaire corporate lawyer, makes perfect sense. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you today. Tomorrow, John Berlow will be here, the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, on why he thinks the stimulus package is not the path to economic recovery. Geez, maybe we'll agree. Slate.com's Fred Kaplan joins us to talk about his new book, Daydream Believers, How Free a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, with exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.